I'll come up here and present. Thanks for having me. It's great to be here. Speaking about Project Tundra, the future of the coal industry, while Stacy really is going to handle more of the particulars about Project Tundra, I wanted to back up maybe even 100 years and kind of review what gets us to this point and really talk about energy policy development justification and outcomes and why after 100 years of energy policy development you get to the point where we in North Dakota are debating what you do with CO2 and a utility is preparing to make, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars investment in this technology. I don't want to dwell too much on this. Prior to the Industrial Revolution, you know, human and animal labor were the major sources of energy. Wealth and prosperity were really related to how many humans you could control and animals you can control, right? And that labor was transformed into wealth with small mechanical improvements, and energy policy really didn't exist. As that Industrial Revolution came about, those first energy policies objectives sought to spread and create wealth and prosperity, not necessarily among everyone, but among those folks who controlled that ability. Once electricity was proven as a concept and a way to power machinery, the policy that was enabled, or the policy that was enacted, was rapid electrification. The reaction to that policy was creativity among electricity distribution. And if you go back a little bit farther than Industrial Revolution, you're talking about competing, you know, do you have AC or DC power? Are you going to have microgrids in every city? Are you going to have a distribution model that looks more like we do now? But the reaction came to look more and more like what we have today with large co-ops. Early in the 20th century, you had significant government investment. The Tennessee Valley Authority had as a policy the rapid electrification of that Tennessee Valley, the creation of wealth, and the improvement in the quality of life among those inhabitants. Those policies, many of them came about as part of the New Deal when the government was investing in millions of things. But it was supporting that objective and that reality that electricity provides wealth and prosperity and makes people's lives better. Energy didn't come directly from human labor anymore. Energy began to come from machines which were, by and large, fed by fossil fuels. The objective, then, was successful as mechanical advantages and machines transformed that energy into wealth and prosperity for those folks. At this time, there was very little of what you would call an R&D infrastructure such as we have today, that much of it is overseen by the federal government. States have a large role. There is little to that at this point in the energy world. You move on into that wartime and post-war expansion. The objectives then shifted from providing a broad base of prosperity to a wide swath of people. And the objective shifted to providing energy for the industrial machinery to transform energy into wealth and military might. Let me give you a specific policy that was enacted in the Pacific Northwest, was to accelerate dam development. When this policy was done, was enacted, they didn't know what the result would be. They said, if we build excess capacity, industry will come, and it will be a benefit for the Pacific Northwest. So they built dams up and down the Columbia. The response after that policy was enacted was a large-scale development of aluminum. Aluminum processing takes a lot of electricity. It's very energy intense. And because the investments had been made in the Pacific Northwest to eventually invest in electricity but not create load for that electricity, industrial manufacturers flocked there because the electricity was essentially free. Was that objective to provide energy for the for industrial machinery to transform energy into wealth and military might successful? Absolutely, it was successful. In 1948, President Roosevelt said that we could not have won the war without the Grand Coulee Dam, because that was the driver for much of the military might that was eventually transformed from raw aluminum with free electricity into a vast number of airplanes, Boeing, that whole development of the aircraft industry in the Northwest is really directly traced back to this policy to develop electricity, to develop and use our natural resources. At this point, There was growing R&D, particularly in the nuclear industry, but there was also minor but growing opposition and increasing timelines for the projects. The dams that were built at the tail end of this process were taking a lot longer than the dams that were built at the front end of this process, right? So people, the culture around energy development is beginning to change. The objectives are being completed, but the culture is beginning to change. Moving on in the timeline, stretching after the post-war into maybe the early 80s, our objective began to be increasing energy security. You have very specific policies now that were implemented that have repercussions in North Dakota to this day, and that we're still feeling, we're still dealing with these. And it's happened quick enough that the energy industry has lived to see two sides of federal policies that really are contradictory to each other. One of those policies was the prohibition of natural gas being used for power plants in 1974. So because the objective was to increase energy security, the thought was we were going to run out of natural gas, and that needed to be used for other more important objectives. And so the policy shifted to incentivize the creation and deployment of large coal power plants. This is right in the heart of when North Dakota's coal industry and our major power plants began to be constructed. So the reaction to this policy was the rapid deployment of coal power plants, including in North Dakota. Was that objective successful? It really was, because we became much more energy secure because of those investments and because of those policies that were made. There was also the significant R&D that really began to filter out into the private industry as well, as the nuclear industry shifted away from government projects more into the private sector. This is also the time frame when many of our nuclear power plants were built, again supporting that policy objective to increase energy security. However, also increasing was public engagement and concern relating to energy development. There was major transmission controversies in our neighbor in Minnesota, where you would have really literally armed groups of people who were protesting large transmission towers. Similarly, as nuclear power was beginning to be developed in Minnesota, which doesn't have those coal resources like North Dakota does, there was significant opposition at the Capitol in Minnesota to the growth of nuclear power. You read the stories of the early disputes that would happen in some of the Capitol buildings around the country, and Minnesota is one of them, where the state police or the police would have to come and make sure that there was no shenanigans going on. And you look at what happens today and you think, well, it has improved a little, I guess. But that increase in cultural engagement in the energy policy development really began to be seen here in this time frame, and the timelines really began to be extended in these projects. It became a lot harder to say, here's the policy, here's the objective, let's get it done, because the policies were becoming more convoluted and more confused by the engagement of a really interested public. And now you've kind of, after that, moved into the environmentalist movement, when those objectives that were present at the beginning of the 20th century really were no longer at the top of anybody's list for energy policy. You're no longer really interested in spreading wealth and prosperity to people. You are more interested in how is this going to impact the environment. And I guess that's good news, because that first wave of policy objectives had been successful. Really, the standard of living between the first slide and this slide is tenfold. And so people had the luxury, I guess, of saying, what is it going to do to this riverbed? What is it going to do to this endangered species? What's going to happen here? The policies also got more specific. And you also began to see what happens when policies get very specific. Industry and the public and the world reacts maybe unexpectedly. I'll give you an example. As the Clean Air Act amendments of 1977 and 90 were passed, you know, the objectives were to reduce acid rain, other forms of pollution. And some of those objectives were to really begin reducing the amount of coal that was being linked directly to these things. A little bit of inside baseball. Many of you know this, but you know, the energy policy for the United States is really set by Natural Resources Committee in the United States Senate. And that's because early on, the United States Senate recognized that natural resources are energy. And as these amendments were being debated in 1977, 1990, saying what's our objective to reduce acid rain, to reduce pollution, that the energy policy power was concentrated in the United States Senate on Energy and Natural Resources, which was dominated by Western senators. And what they were able to do is create a policy that, while it did reduce acid rain and pollution, it gave advantages to the type of coal that is found in the West. And so you saw a really significant shift from higher sulfur coals that were being used in the East to lower sulfur coals that were being used in the West. And while, yes, this was in response to that objective to reduce acid rain and pollution, it was also directly related to how energy policy is actually made, the nuts and bolts of it on a day-to-day basis in Congress, in the Energy and Natural Resources Committee, which is dominated by Western senators. So you see, this is really a great example of how energy policy is made matters, and not just the objective. And you look behind the scenes, and it's not just about reducing that sulfur content, but it was also about really astute senators who were able to see an opportunity and make the best of it. So this is also a time where research and development was still happening at a pretty significant level in the federal government. This overlaps with the time frame that the federal government and others made serious investments in the Synfuels plant, being able to kind of taper off from that last concern of energy insecurity. Can we make our own natural gas? Can we leverage our research and development assets to make our lives better, our world more energy secure? So at the end of the slide, you ask, was that policy objective successful? Absolutely it was. When's the last time you heard about anyone seriously complaining about acid rain? And it was because of those amendments were successful in doing that. But you also look behind the scenes and visualize how it changed the coal industry from one that was dominated by Eastern interests to one that was dominated by Western interests. And now you move into the more modern era. I don't know when I'd say this begins, but if you classify it by the objectives are to reduce climate change, it's a relatively recent 25, 30-year phenomenon, maybe. This is a time when the policies become a little bit more convoluted because the objective is harder to achieve and especially harder to quantify. You know, the Clean Power Plan that President Obama unveiled, its objective was to reduce the damage by climate change. But if by any form of evaluation, full compliance with the Clean Power Plan would have had zero impact on climate change. So you begin to see, because there is more fine details in those energy policy objectives and they're focusing on broader problems, success is harder to define. The reaction to these policies has been major research and development has been transferred, continues at the federal level, but also transferring to the private level. What you also see is a less linear regulatory and industry progression. You know, you could go back to that slide and say the challenge is acid rain, here's the solution, industry's going to go fix it. We've been hearing concern about climate change for a couple decades now, and there hasn't been really nothing that looks like the Clean Air Act to make that really huge bite at solving that challenge. However, that your industry has not waited for the government to weigh in 100% and say this is what you shall do. And so you've seen industry groups focusing on their own on what do you do with carbon dioxide. And that's really been a benefit because it has allowed industry to look at CO2 not as a sulfur that is something that is a pollutant to get rid of, but more as an opportunity to say, you know, while people are talking about carbon dioxide and is it a pollutant, is it not a pollutant, maybe we can do something with carbon dioxide that is beneficial. Maybe we can take that carbon dioxide and turn it into something that is good instead of just simply treating it as a pollutant. And so that's really one of the changes that as energy policy, those big steps have slowed from the federal government. Development and concern has been picked up by the private sector. And that's one of the things that you're going to see about Project Tundra is this doesn't necessarily work because the government says you shall control CO2. That background conversation is always on that CO2 is something that the EPA or that the Supreme Court has declared is a pollutant. And how are we going to respond to that reality that CO2 is in the top of our policymakers' minds and it's in the top of public pressure minds? There's investor groups, there's financing that are all built around your carbon footprint. And so industry has had a little bit of flexibility to decide how are we going to respond to this. So, you know, you circle back and you say, if the objective is to reduce climate change, have we been successful? Can we even be successful? And I don't know the answer to that. But if the objective is to continue to spread that wealth and prosperity to our people while overlapping with many of the most significant environmental challenges of the day, then that focus and that growth of the research and development industry has provided a blueprint that will get us into the future. And with that, I just wanted to transition more into the future and where North Dakota fits in this. What we've realized is that if you're going to do anything with carbon dioxide, North Dakota has a great opportunity to be part of the solution. Our emission sources are in close proximity to where you could potentially put that CO2. And there's immense possibility to store CO2 underground. We've got opportunities to use carbon dioxide to spin the turbine in a power plant instead of using steam. That's called the Allum cycle. So you'd be able to build a brand new power plant that didn't have a stack for anything to go out. A smaller footprint, more efficient, economically competitive with natural gas. Or we've got all of these assets. Again, remember, these were built in a time when the government said, you shall not build gas. So now we have this great installed asset in the country. And how are we going to make that work as it was intended to provide the maximum benefit for a long period of time? What Minn Kota is working on is potentially a solution to that, to retrofit some of that existing high-value asset with technology that would capture the CO2 and do something useful with it or store it deep underground. And so that is what Stacy will talk a little bit more about. So what's next is to drive that CO2 industry, find those partnerships, study the enhanced oil recovery needs that CO2 might offer, figure out what state policy needs would be needed to make this happen, and make sure that the state of North Dakota's policy is to maximize the energy resources that it has in a way that's environmentally compatible. I think that's something that everybody could agree on. You know, any new CO2 incentive that we might have would maximize the value of that value or that CO2 for oil recovery. We could add a 20-year exemption from oil taxes that would make sure that if you're using CO2 from a coal power plant and putting that into the oil field, that you're creating incentives to leverage the infrastructure, the resources that North Dakota has for the future. And so I just wanted to cover a broad segment of time stretching back prior to the Industrial Revolution, kind of walk through how energy policy is developed slowly by fits and starts, call out some of those policies that you could specifically visualize how they're coming to North Dakota and really where we might go in the future, what might be next for those energy policies, and kind of set up Stacy to talk more directly about the specifics of how one of these technologies might work in North Dakota. So with that, I'd conclude, turn the time over to Stacy, and I think we could probably do questions at the end of her presentation.